Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sports Talk Chicago's 34th podcast. My name is John Zagluel, owner and operator of this site. We have a lot to get to today, talking about everything in Chicago sports, plus a very special guest later on in the show. But first, just a few quick announcements. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Instagram, Google Plus, and LinkedIn at John Zags, and on Twitter at John Z Sports. Also, if you're looking for a place here in the Chicago area to book parties, paint your own pottery, and have art classes for both adults and children, check out the Arts and Crafts Studio by Moochie World, where inspiration meets creation. You can find them at the Tinley Park Down Shopping Center at 7913 West 171st Street in Tinley Park, Illinois. If you have any questions, give them a call at 708-247-2100. Again, that's 708-247-2100. To start today, we'll be looking at the Cubs. Right now, they're 25-19, 1.5 games away from the division-leading Milwaukee Brewers. Unfortunately, however, that 1.5 game deficit also applies to the Cardinals and Pittsburgh. Each of those teams are all 1.5 games away from the Brewers, so the top of the NL Central right now is a bit crowded. Going to be tough for the Cubs to run away with the division. Nevertheless, some interesting news coming about the Cubs here. They were just named MLB.com's Bullpen of the Week. Their relievers in this past week combined for a 1.80 ERA over 25 innings. And to sweeten the deal, 19 of those 25 innings, Cubs relievers were unscored upon. Pedro Strop recorded 5 scoreless innings, Mike Montgomery recorded 4, Brandon Morrow 3, Steve Cishek 2 2/3, Brian Dunsing 2 1/3, and the newly called up Randy Rosario pitched 2 scoreless. All of those relievers contributed to the Cubs and their success over this past week. The article also sheds some light on the Cubs and how they overcame adversity, because when Yu Darvish started last Tuesday's game against the Braves, he gave up 1 run over 4 innings, but then exited due to a possible calf injury. Yet the Cubs continued to prevail. They had 4 relievers holding Atlanta's offense to 1 run the rest of the way. And by the way, Atlanta today, best record in the National League, some of the best hitters in the National League with Freddie Freeman and Ozzie Albies. That was not an easy task for the Cubs, but they made it work. And I had mentioned in podcasts beforehand that the Cubs and their bullpen, they go hand in hand. That is the biggest strength of this Cubs team right now, and they're finally getting some recognition here from the folks at MLB.com. So a great job by the Cubs bullpen to help out their mediocre starting pitching and their troubled offense, because even though the Cubs record right now stands at 25-19, they still are incurring some problems. Ones that need to get solved if they want a chance to make another run for the World Series. But looking at the pitching staff right now, specifically the starting rotation, John Lester leading the way with a 2.52 ERA, and Kyle Hendricks behind him had 3.40. Luckily enough, Jose Quintana is improving. In our last podcast, we had talked about how his ERA was nearing 6. He's got it down to 4.47 and has 5 wins, leading the Cubs pitching staff. Now, you might be wondering why I'm praising parts of the Cubs pitching staff, even though I called them mediocre just a little while ago. Well, that's because Yu Darvish still has an ERA near 5. And although Quintana does lead the team in wins, that ERA is still a bit high. The Cubs right now are improving by far, but they're still not where they need to be. It'd be nice to see all of these starting pitchers with ERAs under 4 for starters, and some of them, including Darvish, ERAs under 3, because the guys in which the Cubs spent money for or traded away lots of prospects for are not necessarily producing. Darvish, the Cubs gave a huge contract to, and about Jose Quintana, the Cubs gave up multiple top prospects for him. I was talking with a White Sox fan the other day, and they were asking me who I thought won that trade with Jose Quintana and Eloy Jimenez. And to this day, I feel like the Sox won that, and I'm very disappointed because of that move. I mean, the White Sox received a future MLB All-Star, and the Cubs, on the other hand, received a washed-up Jose Quintana, who has failed to post an ERA near 3.50 or near his career average in two seasons. Therefore, in retrospect, you can't argue that things have gotten better for the Cubs, and they have in regards to their pitching staff, but they're still nowhere near where they're supposed to be. And the pitching staff, that alone, will cause the downfall for the Cubs because right now, their offense has significantly improved. Albert Elmora is hitting above 300 as well as Chris Bryant. And in the home run category, Javier Baez leads the team with 11, with Bryant and Schwarber tied for 8 right behind him. So the offense is starting to click. The bullpen is continuing to be dominant. It's just the back end of the starting rotation that's causing some problems. The Cubs need to get that figured out if they want a chance to run away with the division. Because as I mentioned right now, you've got 4 teams separated by a game and a half for the division lead. The Cubs need to find a way to rise above all of those contenders. And the way they're going to do that is by effective starting pitching. Moving to the south side and talking about the Chicago White Sox, right now the team is 13-30, 8 games out of the AL Central Division lead. They no longer hold the worst record in baseball anymore. That distinction belongs to the Baltimore Orioles and Kansas City Royals. But here's something that's very interesting. Right now in the AL Central Division, the leader is the Cleveland Indians, but guess what? Their record is 22-23. They have an under 500 record, and they are currently the division leader. That is just mind-boggling to me, and that signifies the fact that this AL Central Division could be shaping up to be the weakest this year in baseball. Nevertheless, there's some good news coming from the Chicago White Sox. My favorite pitcher on the team, Reynaldo Lopez, finally got his first win of the season. Lopez, in a start against the Texas Rangers, pitched 8 innings, allowing a season-low 2 hits and 2 walks while striking out 8. The start lowered his home ERA to 1.85 and his overall ERA to 2.98. Lopez has made 9 starts this season. That was his first win of the year. I kept comparing him in previous podcasts to Jeff Samardzija because of the fact that he has a good ERA, yet just for some reason cannot get a win. Finally, however, it's all good as Lopez finally gets his first win of the year. Unfortunately, however, Lopez getting his first win is the only bright spot for this White Sox starting rotation. A big piece of news that came out recently, Carson Fulmer, who has a 2-4 record and an 8.07 ERA at the major league level, has recently been demoted to AAA. Fulmer himself is a former first-round pick, but he's had some problems at the major league level getting adjusted because in his rookie season, he went 0-2 with an ERA near 8.5 and last year took a turn for the better, pitching to an ERA under 4 in 7 games. But this season has been nothing short of a train wreck. In 9 games and 8 starts, he has a 2-4 record and his ERA is over 8. More importantly, however, I feel that we need to recognize what's going on with Fulmer here because this guy was a first-round pick by the White Sox and he was picked near the beginning of the rebuild, yet he's not turning out the way people envision. Fulmer was a beast at Vanderbilt, did very good things over there, and even started in the College World Series for them. But since coming to the White Sox and since making his Major League debut, he hasn't done a thing to positively affect the White Sox, and obviously that's why he was sent down to AAA. To make matters worse, we could see another starting pitcher on the White Sox roster at the moment get sent down to AAA as well. Lucas Giolito, who's posted an ERA near 6.5 this season, is now in trouble of losing his starting rotation spot. Giolito, if you don't remember, was acquired by the White Sox as a part of the Adam Eaton trade, but right now Giolito is not living up to his expectations. Although he is 23 years old and still has some time to grow, this too is his third year in the MLB, and last year he made some significant strides to become a better pitcher. His ERA was under 3.0, he made 7 starts, and posted 34 strikeouts in 45 innings. Yet this season, it's been an entirely different story. In 9 starts, he's 3-4 with an ERA at 6.42. That's not going to cut it at the major league level, so I wouldn't be surprised if Giolito, similar to Fulmer, gets sent down to AAA. On the offensive side of things, a couple of bright spots for the Sox. Right now, Jose Abreu hitting .299 with 8 homers and 25 RBIs. Yoelmer Sanchez hitting .281, so he's living up to his raise that he got via arbitration over the offseason. And Matt Davidson is hitting .239 but has 11 homers and an OPS just under .900. So a couple of offensive stars, but some problems with their pitching staff is causing the White Sox to lose multiple games. And until they can find another player like Reynaldo Lopez, a guy who can pitch to an ERA under 3.0, they're going to have trouble staying in games. Because when you start the first or second inning already down by 5 runs, it's going to be very difficult for the offense to recover that quickly. Unfortunately for the White Sox, because they have guys like Shields, Giolito, and Fulmer, guys with ERAs above 5, they're going to have major problems trying to win games as we go throughout the season. Moving from the baseball diamond to the gridiron, we're going to talk about some Chicago Bears news and 2 interesting pieces of news as the Bears continue during OTAs. Number 1, Ryan Pace recently sat down with Dan Pompey of The Athletic and talked about some offseason needs and how the Bears approached free agency. Well, it turns out the Bears were very interested in and made a play for Malcolm Butler of the New England Patriots. Here's a quote from the article. Pace wasn't looking to hit singles. The top receivers in free agency were Allen Robinson and Sammy Watkins. Pace's goal was to get one of them. He also made a pitch for Malcolm Butler, one of the top free agent cornerbacks. Malcolm Butler being on the Bears could have been something really special. I mean, this guy is a former Pro Bowl cornerback, a guy who has played 11 postseason games and has 3 rings. So, I mean, his experience and his expertise and, more importantly, his skill set could have really helped this Bears team. Now, of course, the Bears made many moves in the offseason to help further their chances at making a playoff appearance, but adding Malcolm Butler could have really made some headlines. It's unfortunate that Butler chose the Titans over the Bears during free agency. One more piece of news about the Bears. Pro Football Focus lists the Bears as a potential surprise playoff team in 2018. Very interesting news. Here's what the article had to say about the Bears. Quote, no less than 5 additions on offense this offseason could make key impacts for the Bears, including wide receiver Allen Robinson, who was one of the NFL's best in 2015 before a down year in 2016 and essentially missing all of 2017 through injury. He's joined at the position by Taylor Gabriel, who had 3 touchdowns on throws 20 yards or further downfield in 2016, and rookie Anthony Miller, who is tied for 4th among wide receivers in this draft class with 19 missed tackles forced on receptions. Add in tight end Trey Burton, who had 3 touchdowns from just 16 targets when lined up in the slot, and rookie offensive lineman James Daniels from Iowa, and it's easy to see why this offense led by Mitchell Trubisky has the potential to trend upwards big time in 2018. The article does make some good points, but personally speaking, I can't see the Bears making the playoffs just yet. They need some time to come together as a team, which is why I'd say they'd go 8-8 this upcoming season. Still very respectable and still much better than the years under the John Fox regime, but I think it'll take a year or two before the Bears reach the playoffs once again. Nevertheless, everyone is taking notice about the Bears and their draft day additions as well as their free agency finds. They are going to become better, and they're going to become a team to be feared here in the near future. And at this point, we'll move on and talk about the Chicago Bulls. And right now, they're deciding who they're going to take with that number 7 overall selection in the draft. Right now, some reports are coming out about who the Bulls interviewed during the draft combine. So here are some of the names they talked to. Mohamed Bamba, Keary Thomas, Wendell Carter Jr., and Miles Bridges. They did not interview Michael Porter yet, but according to his agent, Mark Bartlestein, who runs a company right here in Chicago, Porter is scheduled to meet with the Bulls soon and is already preparing for the draft by working out here in Chicago as well. So some interesting connections here for the Bulls. And with this 7th overall pick, it's going to be difficult to see who the Bulls should try and draft because there are two obvious candidates right now, Wendell Carter Jr. and Michael Porter Jr. It's going to be those two. The question is, however, who will provide more upside for this Bulls team? So, Wendell Carter Jr., in college, he only played one season at Duke, averaged 13.5 points per game and 9.1 rebounds per game. He's listed as a forward, but could play center as he's 6'10 and 260 pounds. Michael Porter Jr., listed as a forward as well, 6'10 but 215 pounds. So, Porter, more so a small forward, possibly a power forward. So, at this point, the question is, what do the Bulls need and what do they need to opt for? Are they looking for someone who can provide size and weight and a big body like Wendell Carter Jr.? Or are they looking for someone who could be explosive and flashy on the offensive end while still providing quality minutes, including rebounds? Because that would be Michael Porter Jr. And the thing is, I was very high on Wendell Carter because I know what he can bring to this team. Robin Lopez is on his way out, the Bulls need a new center, and having Carter teaming him up with Markkanen would be a nice 1-2 combo in the front court. But I feel that right now the Bulls need to put their attention on Michael Porter Jr. Now I know that Porter has been hurt. He's only played in 3 games in his entire college tenure. Despite that, however, I still feel like he provides so much for the Bulls. This guy was a number one recruit out of high school and could have went first overall if he simply got a chance to play in college. But because of that injury, that spinal injury that occurred in his 3rd game, he was unable to ever come back to the court. I feel like that if Porter has recovered fully from that injury, he'll be the same player as before, and he'll be one of the best players out of this year's draft. Although it is somewhat of a what-if scenario, I still feel that Porter would bring so much to the table for the Bulls. Because I'm sick of seeing the team pick guys who don't work out or pick the non-flashy picks. They're always going with a safe pick, the Bulls, and I think right now they need to take a risk that could benefit this team. Sure, you could argue that Porter may never have recovered fully from that injury, therefore not providing much for this team. But if he did, Porter is the best player in this draft class in that case. And the Bulls have a chance to get him. So that's why I feel like, in this sense, Michael Porter Jr. is the way to go, and the Bulls should seriously consider taking him with that 7th overall pick. And before we get to our special guest, let's talk about some Chicago Blackhawks news. The Hawks announced Monday that they have signed German forward Dominic Cahoon, defensive prospects Lucas Carlson and Darren Radish, and Finnish goaltender Kevin Lankinen. All 4 of those players have signed 2-year or 3-year contracts. The biggest get out of these 4 players is Cahoon, who's 22 years old and helped guide Germany to a silver medal in the Winter Olympics this year with 2 goals and 3 assists. Cahoon has spent the previous 4 seasons playing in Germany's top league, setting career highs with 29 assists, 41 points, and tying a career best with 12 goals, while leading München to its 3rd straight title. And another huge news story coming out of the Hawks organization, Marian Hossa, who sat out all of last season due to a skin condition, has now confirmed to a Slovakian newspaper that he is indeed done and will never be returning to the NHL. He is retired. According to the report, Hossa said, "I'm done playing hockey. I have a valid contract with Chicago for another 3 years, but I only have 1 health, and it does not allow me to return." Hossa will certainly be missed here in Chicago. In 19 NHL seasons, Hossa scored 525 goals and notched 609 assists. His value in the postseason was also punctuated with 149 points. In 8 years for the Hawks, Hossa had 186 goals and 229 assists. When Hossa signed with the Hawks, it was a 12-year, $63.3 million deal, and that was seen as symbolic toward the Hawks' commitment to winning a Stanley Cup. And sure enough, he stayed along for the ride as he helped the Hawks win 3 Stanley Cups. Although it is a shame to see Hossa go, he did mention that he has discussed a future job in the Blackhawks organization. Wherever Hossa ends up, We wish him well in his retirement, and thank you for his countless years of production here with the Chicago Blackhawks. And with that, it's time for our special guest. He began his NFL career in 1979 with the Philadelphia Eagles before playing three seasons in Cleveland. By 1985, he became an NFL coach, starting as the special teams coach with the Browns. In 1992, he was named the head coach of the Pittsburgh Steelers, where he spent 15 years with the team, winning Super Bowl 40 while finishing as an eight-time division champion. Today, he is an analyst on the NFL Today on CBS. Please welcome Coach Bill Cowher to the show. And Coach, how are you doing today? And thank you for being here on the show.
Doing great, John. Fantastic. Enjoying this offseason and looking forward to another NFL season coming up.
So first off, Coach, I wanted to get your impressions on the 2018 NFL draft because there were lots of teams who made some franchise-altering picks or ones that could really propel a team's future. So in your opinion, who do you think won this year's draft?
Well, it's hard to say. I always said with the draft, I think you can only evaluate it after 3 years because you really got to see how it plays out, you know, what players are able to contribute, and because sometimes the contribution may not come in the first year. So I think it's a part of the process, and I think when you evaluate a draft, give it 3 years and then take a look back. But certainly, you know, a lot of quarterbacks came into play. A lot of focus was there, but as you call me from Chicago, I love the first round pick of Rohan Smith. I think he's a great linebacker, a very good linebacker for years to come with that defense with Vic Fangio. And I think what they did also in the offseason with, you know, all of a sudden now putting some weapons around Mitch Trubisky, you know, going out and getting Allen Robinson and getting Taylor Gabriel and a Burton at the tight end. So I like what they've done. I think with Matt Nagy, I think there's a lot of excitement there should be in the Chicago area.
Building off of that point, and that serves as a perfect segue into my next question, do you feel that the Bears are setting themselves up for success with these moves? Because there was an article released yesterday, I believe on Pro Football Weekly, saying that the Bears are a potential surprise playoff team come this season. So what do you think about that, and what do you think about all these moves the Bears have made?
Well, like I said, I love what they've done. You have one of the best 1-2 punches in Jordan Howard and Tariq Cohen in the backfield. And, you know, I think with Mitch Trubisky, you got to put some weapons around him. We've all been waiting for Kevin White, but right now I don't think you have to wait for Kevin White. And hopefully he can supplement, you know, this receiving core that you went out and kind of revamped. And so I like what they did. I think Matt Nagy's good. I think keeping Vic Fangio to bring some stability on the defensive side of the ball is an excellent move on his part. It's a tough division, and make no mistake about it. The Detroit Lions, when you look at talking about Matthew Stafford, Aaron Rodgers in Green Bay, and certainly the Minnesota Vikings, who now go out and get Kirk Cousins. It may be one of the toughest divisions in football. And so it's a challenge there, but I'll tell you what, they're going to be competing this year. I like where they are, but more importantly, I like the direction they're heading.
You know, you mentioned some weapons for Mitchell Trubisky. Do you feel that he is capable of being a front-of-the-line starting QB? I mean, last season, sure, there were some growing pains for him, but he finished the season stronger in the way in which he started. So what do you think about Trubisky coming into this season, his second year in the NFL?
Well, the second year is so important. I think for a young quarterback, you know, a lot gets thrown at you in the first year. You go through the draft, you go through the whole process that leads up to that, and then you're going into training camp, and then the first exhibition game was like a regular season game for you as a rookie player. So it's a long year. It's a very trying year, and at the same time, I think what he was able to gather is a lot of experience. I mean, he's an experienced, he's got experience he can build off of. I think he's got a good offensive coordinator and, you know, Mark Herbeck, but more importantly, the head coach knows how to develop quarterbacks. We saw what he did with Alex Smith in Kansas City, and you're looking at kind of the same type of athlete. So I think he can kind of take some of the same things he did with Alex, apply them to Mitchell Trubisky, now put a little bit of a core around him, and keep that offensive line can stay healthy, and he's got a good running game. There's a lot to be excited about. Again, temper the enthusiasm. It's a tough division, but I like what you have. You got good young players around him and a chance, again, to build this thing heading in the proper direction.
You know, I wanted to move to the Browns for a moment because they made some interesting moves in the offseason then via the draft. They drafted Baker Mayfield first overall. So what are your impressions on Mayfield going first overall, and do you feel that he could finally break the QB curse over in Cleveland?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more than just a quarterback. I mean, there's a lot to do when you win one game in 2 years. It's more than just one player, and I think that's important, John, to keep in mind. I like Baker Mayfield. I think Baker Mayfield, of all the quarterbacks in that were in the draft, you know, you're going to have qualities you can look at and you can question this and that. But, you know, he reminds me a little bit of Russell Wilson. He's got great pocket presence. He's got a very strong arm. He doesn't panic. He can go through progressions. The defense will be a little bit more complicated than what he faced, when he was in Oklahoma. But I think at the same time, I like his demeanor. He's got a little bit of a chip on his shoulder. And at the same time, you don't have to force the issue. You have Tyrod Taylor up there. And I think Tyrod Taylor is a very, very good segue to Baker whenever that takes place because they're very similar in style of quarterbacks. So you don't have to change the system. So again, I think the most important thing that they have to do is let it play out. Don't force the issue. But more importantly, try to develop a winning culture. And that's going to be more than just one player, and I think that's the challenge you have right now in Cleveland.
You know, moving to your career as an NFL coach, you won 149 games in 15 years, you won Super Bowl 40, and your winning percentage as a coach was over 600, so I wanted to ask you, why do you think you were such a successful head coach, and what attributed to that winning culture? You mentioned it with Cleveland. How were you able to do it for such a long period of time there in Pittsburgh?
Well, you know what, John, when you look at the NFL, it's about, number one, it's about players. You have to have players to be able to work with. Number two, you have to have continuity in systems, and, you know, sometimes it takes patience with an owner, and at the same time, also with your coaching staff, is the people you surround yourself with, and getting good coordinators and good assistant coaches. And the most important quality with that is they have to be good teachers. I think because what coaching is teaching. And I think with teaching, it's a way of communicating with players, being patient, having a way to understand what makes them tick. And so we were able to surround ourselves with good assistant coaches, with good players. And, you know, we created a culture where we held people accountable, you know, and I think that was something that when you walked in there, you know, your leaders kind of ruled that locker room. So I think it's developing the right leadership with some of your players. And I think, again, you don't know who that is. And I think sometimes that has to evolve. And so part of the evolution was there, and we were able to then carry that on as kind of a traditional thing as we did from year to year.
You know, I wanted to go back to Super Bowl 40. What was it like for you to finally win it all? Because I know 10 years before in Super Bowl 30, you guys ended up losing. So you've been on both ends of the coin before. So what did it feel like to win?
I was a long road traveled. Yeah, it was 13 years, and that's pretty late to win your first Super Bowl. But at the same time, we were always knocking on the door, and you know, and many times we fell short. But the one thing is, by falling short, it wasn't a case of having to rewrite something, re-script something. We just kind of picked up and, you know, so we wanted to do a little bit more the next year. And so we never forgot, you know, where we came from. We never lost our identity. And we try to create an identity every year that matched our personnel. And sometimes that changed. And so I think, again, you know, some of the best teams we had didn't win championships, didn't win a championship. That was not our best team I had in my 15 years in Pittsburgh, but it's probably the closest team we had. Tremendous team chemistry. So, you know, again, it was, you know, very proud of what we did over the course of 15 years in Pittsburgh, you know, with the coaching staff, the players we had, and certainly it culminated with that win in Super Bowl 40 in Detroit.
By the way, in that game, I'm sure many people remember the play where Antoine Randle-El, a wide receiver, threw a 43-yard touchdown pass to Hines Ward, and that was the first time in Super Bowl history that a wide receiver threw a touchdown pass. So I wanted to ask you, who came up with that play, and why'd you guys decide to run it?
Well, we had a number of those plays that year. I think if you think about the players that we had that playing a receiver, Hines Ward, who also was a college quarterback, we had him there. There were times in our career we had Cordell Stewart playing receiver as well. He was a quarterback in college. And Antoine, as you said, he played in Indiana. He was a quarterback who kind of transitioned into a slot receiver. And so, you know, when you have multi-skilled players, the things you like to do, and I've always thought that I think keeping – gadget plays or gimmick plays, as you would call it, sort of speak, they kind of keep offenses or defenses off balance, and it kind of just slows them down a little bit. So it had been a play we had practiced pretty much all year long. Ken Whisenhunt called it at the right time, and I just reminded him earlier, a couple of quarters earlier, that last time I looked, we don't have a game next year, so let's not leave anything in the bag. Or next week, I said, because I said, you know, this is our last game we're playing, no matter what happens. So let's make sure we use all of our arsenal. And he made a great call at the right time.
You know, talking about all of your time as a coach makes me wonder why you stepped away after 2007. Why'd you decide to end your time with Pittsburgh And also, will we ever see you coach again?
Well, I never say never, John. You know, certainly they never shut a door. You don't have to, but I certainly enjoy my job at CBS. I enjoy the, more importantly, the offseason that I'm able to experience now and the freedom as I have. We still have the same platform and still be able to talk about the game I've loved so much. And, you know, at the time I stepped down, it was just a lot of different factors. I was, you know, blessed to have won a championship. I played, did it for 15 years. It was just time for me to move on to the next phase of my life. And, you know, I'm like I said, I was just very happy and blessed to be able to have CBS as a platform where I can kind of transition right from playing to being in the, on the other side of it and talking about it on Sundays. And at the same time, it's allowed me to have an off season where I have four grandkids, another one on the way, and I'm able to enjoy the kind of a somewhat of a normality of life that you can't really do as a head coach. And so I've been able to travel and do things I couldn't do otherwise, and I have no regrets and not looking back, and at the same time looking forward. I never say never, but probably highly unlikely.
What was the best part for you about being a head coach in the NFL?
I love competing, and I love competing on Sundays, putting together game plans, making the decisions you have to make. I think the most important thing is I love working with players. I love working with coaches. It was just a camaraderie and a special bond that you get when you come together in training camp and you put all this time and effort and work and the emotional highs and lows you have, and it culminates every Sunday with a win and loss. And as the season unfolds, it starts to come down to, you know, the reality of whether you're going to continue or not continue. So there was finality with what we did. There was competition with what we did, but there was also a unique bond with what we did that the experiences that people can never take away from you. So just love the, I love competing and I love working with players and coaches and teaching and, you know, the family atmosphere you kind of create with the football team. So you spend probably more time with them than you do with your own family. And at the same time, you got to have a great support staff. I had a great wife at the time and my children grew up in it. And so it, provided really a great lifestyle, and Pittsburgh was a tremendous place to coach. And talk about family, no greater family than the Rooneys. So I was very blessed to have a great 15 years coaching and still a part of the NFL with my next family, that being CBS.
And on a final note, I wanted to ask you about your coaching persona, and I'm sure this is a question you've been asked a lot because it has been chronicled in the past about you always being, you know, angry or furious, and I just wanted to know why that is, why you were so, you know, maybe angry or more of a competitor on the field, I guess.
Well, I think, number one, I wouldn't call myself angry. I was an emotional coach who wore his emotions on his sleeves. Unfortunately, when I was happy and cheering guys, that didn't make good TV. They always liked to see me when I wasn't happy. And so, you know, I just was who I was. And I think any player that ever played for me, the one thing you can say is that, you know, I kept it real, you know, and I told it the way it was. I didn't try to sugarcoat things. I patted them on the back when they did well. And I let them know when it wasn't done well. I held them to, you know, a degree of excellence that I demanded from them. And, you know, and I demand it for myself as well. So, you know, I think when you look at it, they were like I had three girls at home and 53 boys at work. And sometimes the same conversations you have with your kids, you have with the guys at work. We were a family. And part of that family was part of me is making sure I could get the best out of them and make sure when they walked away from the game that it wasn't because I didn't push them to be as good as they could be. And that was my job as a coach. And at the same time, I appreciated each and every one of them and thought of them and treated them all as if they were my son.
Well, Coach Cowher, thank you so much for being here on the show. It was quite an honor and a pleasure.
Thanks, John.
Once again, thank you to Coach Bill Cowher for being here on the show today. We talked about his great coaching career in Pittsburgh, his chances of returning to the field, and some Chicago Bears news. And with that, we're moving on now to our closing segment, our announcer's call of the day. Here's the situation. It's Game 3 of the Eastern Conference semifinals. Right now, Toronto and Cleveland are tied up at 103 as Cleveland gets ready to inbound. What happens next is something amazing. Let's listen to Mark Jones for the call.
Make sure you do not foul anybody here on the dribble.
It's going to be James.
Sure. Here it is. James under
3 seconds.
Under three.
Throws up the floater. Oh, good night, Cleveland. That is for you.
A great call there by Mark Jones and a great shot by LeBron James. Well, that does it for us here at Sports Talk Chicago. Follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram, all at John Zags, and on Twitter at John Z Sports. Also, make sure to subscribe to the website. You can enter your email inside the box on the homepage. This will allow you to receive email updates whenever a new podcast or article is posted on the website. Thank you again for listening, and have a great day.